Hello and welcome to the Eastman Financial Report. I'm Dan Eastman, your host, and today is Tuesday, November 7th, 2023. Thank you so much for tuning in to the Eastman Financial Report and to WVW-TV. We appreciate your viewership, and we're very happy to be able to bring you great quality programming. And of course, as you know, there's no paywall or subscriptions. It's free 24/7 for you to watch and to review. There certainly are many recorded programs available as well. So thank you so much for tuning in. We really appreciate it. And we appreciate your support as well. As you know, if you're interested in supporting WVW-TV's mission and ministry, you can reach out to the foundation, and I'm sure they will be more than happy to count you among their supporters. We also have sponsors for our network, as you know, and for the sponsor for my show is Swiss America Trading, which is a company in Arizona, based out of Arizona. It's an American company that provides a market for precious metals, tangible precious metals. If you're interested in buying some precious metals for your own personal portfolio or for perhaps gift giving this holiday season, you should reach out to Swiss America at 1-800-519-6271 and ask them to send you some free information on what they have to offer. They're more than happy to mail it out, and you'll be able to learn a lot about the market for tangible precious metals. And that means metal you can hold in your hand. It's tangible. You can also go to their website, SwissAmerica.com, and you can shop around and see what they have. And if you use the promo code Eastman on the website, which stands for Eastman Financial Report, then they'll be happy to send you the same free information. And they're also running a special right now, either by phone or on the internet. Basically, they are offering silver bullion coins. These are the half dollar, the Liberty Standing half dollar bullion coins. And they're selling them at the price of $13.50, which includes shipping, which is a big deal because precious metals are by nature heavy. And if you're interested in adding to your collection or portfolio, this is a great time to take advantage of that offer. It's $13.50, includes shipping. There they are right on the screen. And they're minted by the U.S. government and high quality, of course. And that offer, you can buy up to 250 of these coins. And of course, that's up until they're sold out, and then the offer goes away. So if you're thinking about gift giving for the holidays and you're looking for something a little bit unique that somebody will hang on to instead of use and throw into a landfill, certainly precious metals might just fit the bill, especially at $13.50. That's a really good price, which includes shipping. Swiss America also has block bullion, basically bullion manufactured by refiners throughout the world, high quality metals. Silver and gold. So if you're interested in more than just a coin, you can buy the bullion. And of course, they also have numismatic coins, which are coin collector coins. And those also have, you know, gold or silver content. And of course, they also have attributes like collectability and rarity, scarcity, which mint it was made. So anyway, if you're looking at tangible precious metals for your portfolio or to give as gifts, give Swiss America a call, 1-800-519-6271, or go to the website, SwissAmerica.com, use the promo code Eastman, and take advantage of that $13.50 special on silver half dollars, including shipping, which is a great deal. So, thank you so much to Swiss America. We appreciate your sponsorship, and we're very thankful for your long relationship with WVW-TV. Okay, let's jump into the news. Of course, as I said yesterday, this is the second week or the first full week of November. And of course, financial news is a little sparse this time of year. We are into the fourth quarter of the year. And pretty much that has been done, And now everyone is sort of waiting to see what happens in 2024, which of course will be a crazy year because it's an election year. And we still have a lot of moving parts and pieces in our current economy. I did notice one headline, which is almost becoming a sort of broken record-ish at this point. But the next federal government shutdown is scheduled for November 18th. Which is only 11 days away, unless the Congress can pass continuing resolutions and keep the government funded and functioning. And of course, this is now the third time we've talked about this since my program went live last early spring. And it seems to be a reoccurring problem at the federal level where we don't have an annual budget bill that passes and is signed by the president and it binds everybody to spending a predetermined and pre-agreed upon amount. We have long since given up the budget bill idea and are going to these continuing resolutions, which Congress passes and the president signs. And basically what it says, you can continue spending at this program, at this funded amount for another period of time. And of course, it's still very early in the crazy season with respect to this particular government shutdown. So two primary deals are sort of emerging as being on the table. And one of them, I might as well go through both and we'll talk about them. There's the pass the four easy ones right away. There's 12 continuing resolutions, okay? Four of them are sort of no-brainer-ish and they're easy to pass, and eight are harder ones. So one thought is, why don't we pass the four early ones now so it looks like we're doing something, and then we'll pass a continuing resolution for the eight harder ones, and we'll punt it until mid-January of 2024. That gets us through the holiday season, through the end of the year, it takes this issue off the table, and everybody can go and have a Thanksgiving and Christmas and holiday season and not be bothered with the government shutting down for the fourth time in 2023. Well, that's plan number one. Plan number two, of course, is just extend the whole thing until January of 2024. Pass the early ones, and the easy ones and the hard ones, and just punt the whole thing to January 24, and we'll have a great vacation over the holiday season, and we'll deal with the whole thing in January. Now, there's a risk to that, of course, because there's all sorts of shenanigans to be played. It's not just pass the bill so the Department of whatever can continue operating. These are always used as lever points. I'll vote for, the Department of whatever's bill, but we have to send money to the Ukraine, or we have to send money to Israel, or we have to fund this project, and we have to fund that project. And it's never a clean bill like a budget bill. It's always contingent upon or perhaps, tied to the hip of some spending goal or proposal based upon the special interests in Congress. So as we saw the last two times, we will enter this for the third time now, there's always a lot of horse trading, as they used to say, before anyone in Congress can get a bill before the president's desk. So if you are a gambler, and I'm not, but I also, you burned thrice here, so I would expect that on the night of November 17th, just before midnight, they'll still be scrambling around trying to cut a deal, and maybe maybe it'll slip over into the 18th or maybe the 19th, and we'll have some, partial shutdown. And of course, Janet Yellen will be running around saying, "I need to sell bonds. I need to sell bonds." So we're going to watch this 11 days with, not necessarily bated breath, because as my crystal ball prognostication always seems to come true, the government's not going to shut down. I mean, this is just, if you think of the avalanche, that starts at the top of the mountain. Well, we're about halfway down the mountain, and that snowball isn't going back up the hill. So we'll see what Congress does. And of course, with these war situations, it becomes problematic, because when you're trying to fund operations of government and you're making it contingent upon, world events and expensive crises, it creates in the minds of a lot of people this idea that, Washington and spending and money are very much becoming detached from the daily lives of Americans. I mean, if you ask somebody on the street, "Hey, what do you think about the $33 trillion deficit?" they may not know. If they do know, nobody can really grasp what $1 trillion is, let alone 33 of them. I'll give you my example again. If I stand here or sit here and I hand you a dollar bill every second, how long will it take for me to hand you $1 trillion? And the answer is 56,800 and some years. And then I have to do it 33 times. And by the time I'm done, the number will be bigger. So the point is, the average person really isn't paying much attention to this sort of stuff. And it becomes kind of problematic, because the situation needs to be rectified, and there's no easy way out. That's why I keep coming back to my hypothesis that perhaps the only politically savvy or politically palatable way out would, of course, be inflate your way out. And that means make $33 trillion look like a small number. And the only way to do that is to blow general inflation through the economy, which will just devastate. You know, remember my three silos? You've got the poor, then you have the middle class, and you have the rich. Well, in inflationary times, the rich become fabulously wealthy because they buy tangible assets, they buy real estate, and then they can invest in short-term bonds, lots and lots of them, and interest rates are going up and up. Keep in mind, the Argentina interest rates are 133%, according to their central bank. Well, wouldn't it be lovely to put $1 million on deposit and earn 133% interest? Well, if you're rich in this silo, that's, boy, you're making money, or at least you're keeping up with inflation. In the middle, man, that's where you're really getting squeezed. And of course, the poor are just left behind because prices are going up 133% in Argentina, and people don't have real estate and they don't have tangibles that are floating with it, then they're getting poorer by the minute. So the question becomes, with respect to the government, how do you escape this trap? And I think that the only politically palatable way to do that is to inflate and then remonetize. And that becomes a real complex thing. And keep in mind, the American dollar was not invented in 1783, and when the Constitution was drafted in 1889, when the final ratifications of the American Constitution happened, all the dust settled, and we were off in the 1790s, were a new era of amazing opportunism and also optimism, in that it was a brand new country with a brand new constitution, and there was nothing but from sea to shining sea, from the East Coast to the West Coast, nothing but opportunity. And at the end of the day, there wasn't an American dollar that was consistent from that beginning through today. If you look at the United States currency, it has always been a very turbulent place. We don't think about that in the modern era because we basically have had the Federal Reserve since 1913, and we've had the Federal Reserve notes, and we used to have silver certificates and treasury notes. But the reality is, for most of our lifetimes, we've had Federal Reserve notes. It's the dollar, the American dollar, the almighty dollar. So we don't think about the American dollar as having been an evolutionary thing or an iteration or iterative product. But the fact is, it is. I mean, if you think back to the Continental Congress issuing continentals, and the old saying, which nobody remembers, is it's not worth a continental, which means the government printed up a bunch of money backed by nothing, and it was worth nothing. They used to sew it into costumes and dance around as a joke. Then, of course, the American experience happened. We didn't have a federal bank. There were a couple of attempts. And private bank notes became the thing based on gold and silver. And, of course, those banks were always failing, and there were always financial panics. There was credit crunches and credit booms. And then, of course, that whole era ended in 1913 with the advent of the Federal Reserve System. And now we have this iteration. Now, during the Civil War, the 1860s, we had the greenback. We sometimes refer to the dollar as a greenback, but that was a different thing issued by the U.S. Treasury at a time when the United States was basically broken in half. And, people were saying, well, whoever wins the war, the money might not be good. Well, this is where we are, with respect to the financing of the American dollar today. So don't assume that this thing is going to, just be still in circulation 100 years from now, or 50 years, or 10 years. Who knows? It's always under pressure. I think when you look at the Federal Reserve note cycle, it's got a life and it's run a long life. But what we've seen is that they're very easy to print up out of thin air, and now there's 33 trillion of them, in debt. That it's just a lot of debt, and I think that ultimately that solution is going to come home to roost on somebody. I don't know which generation is going to be hard hit by this, but at the end of the day, it's certainly something you want to prepare for, and that's why within these silos, social upward mobility, or economic upward mobility, is something to perhaps aspire to if you have an interest in being a rising tide floats all boats. At least you might have a canoe in the harbor, if not a ship. But at the end of the day, it's a personal strategy. It's a personal decision. So one thing I did want to notice mention is that the Treasury borrowing today, and this goes back to the story about, the government's going to, the appropriations are going to run out, and poor Janet Yellen won't be able to sell bonds, and of course the government will shut down and all that. But when you look at the Treasury borrowing today, It's really as if the United States were in a war, you know, a war mobilization or some crisis situation. And, you know, if you go back to World War II, remember that, you know, they opened the barn door, sold debt to anybody that would buy it, war bonds, you know, and at the end of the day, borrowed like crazy because we're fighting a war that could have had very significant political consequences to the United States if we had lost or perhaps if we had stalemated. So, you know, it's Katie, bar the door, open the barn door out, and sell debt until you have all the money you need, and then pay it back later. And of course, if we look at that phenomenon with the Keynesian multiplier, we realize that that debt has really never gone away since the 1940s. And but in most of that period, we'd run smaller deficits or reasonable deficits. And today we're not doing that. We're spending like we are in the middle of World War III or something. And in fact, you know, these are not times that are challenging the shores of the United States. I mean, we don't have, you know, tanks rolling across Nevada or anything. So the point is, those debt levels are very high, and they lead, and as a result of that, I mean, they come from these continuing resolutions and this idea that Congress is spending money because there's no brake, there's no authority, and there's no bumper, or there's no mechanism that keeps anybody from spending whatever money is necessary to achieve their political goal. And of course, we've got a very polarized government, and we have a government that is tremendously driven by special interests and lobbying forces. Now, you send these people off to Washington, they're not brilliant, you know, Einsteins. They go to Washington, they walk in the front door, there's a caucus, there's lobbyists are all there, there's an agenda, there's special interests. And, you know, welcome to Congress, you know, you're the newbie. And, you know, when we go like this, you go like this, you know, and that's kind of the problem we have, that the system is designed for infinite spending. And we're seeing that in the $33 trillion. You know, it would be one thing if we had just a smidgen of a little debt and, this, you know, I'm old, like David Stockman back in the Ronald Reagan era. He was the budget director, and, you know, and he was just apoplectic when the thought of you know, $1 billion in national debt with a B, not a T, a B, okay, was like, you guys are crazy, you know, voodoo economics. I mean, he was really outspoken and, you know, somewhat embarrassed President Reagan, because here's his budget director going, we are way out of line. Well, it's quaint, you know, he's panicked about $1 billion in debt, and now we're looking at $33 trillion in debt. And David Stockman is, to my knowledge, and I hope, I mean, he's still alive, unless I've missed the headline. I hope he is, and certainly, you know, I encourage his long life for David Stockman. He's always been one of my, you know, economic idols. And but he was the voice of reason, saying, you know, this is getting to be crazy spending. And, you know, if you look back and you look today, we have, you know, it's just, it isn't even crazy anymore. It's just unfathomable and unimaginable. And that has consequences. So we're spending at wartime levels and borrowing at wartime levels to fund expenditures that there are no rational break. So you have to assume, as a citizen of this fine republic, that there's going to be economic blowback to we the people. And that's where you want to start thinking about, how do you position yourself as best you can to ride out that wave. And I think that's, you know, something that is not going to come up in the debates in Washington with respect to these continuing resolutions, because they're just kicking the can down the road. Now, the problem for the administration, and again, this is not a political show and I'm not picking sides here, but the problem is, going into another election season, this opens up a lot of political, you know, risk. Because what you want to be able to say going, you know, seeking re-election is, hey, times are great, it's never been better, you know, put me in again, you know, what do you have to lose? Versus your opponent, who will come along and say, this is the worst economy we've ever had since the Great Depression, and nobody can remember the Great Depression. So at the end of the day, you're really caught in a political conundrum, where the administration is chirping out all of these, you know, the economy's never been better, boy, you know, people are really doing well under my administration. And then you look at the numbers, and it paints a different picture. And I think that becomes, it's going to be a very interesting year as they keep kicking the can down the road, because there will not be in 2024 any appetite for a bloodbath federal budget. Keep in mind, the entire House of Representatives is elected every 2 years, and they're all up for re-election. All 435 of them are up for re-election, and a third of the Senate. And at the end of the day, you know, nobody goes into an election year pounding the table and demanding, budget cuts and spending cuts, because you don't. You want to, you know, throw the money all over the country and everybody's happy. And it's, but, you know, meanwhile, this 33, we know right now it's a $2 trillion burn this year. The burn rate's $2 trillion, which means our income taxes aren't keeping up with our spending by $2 trillion. So we'll be looking at $35 trillion this time next year. And, of course, this time next year, I think, is Election Day, November 7th. It's right around. I mean, this is 1 year from the big show. And this is going to be really an interesting time. So no matter who wins, you know, if you're reelected and you're, you know, cruising right along with continuing resolutions, you just keep spending and the debt's getting bigger and bigger. If you do win, if the other guy wins, other person wins, you might have a real mess on your hands, because somebody is going to have to deal with this situation. So, and you know, it always manifests itself when you look at how the country and how the people react. I noticed a story today that household debt in the United States was up $228 billion with a B in the third quarter, which ended September. The total household debt in the United States is $17.3 trillion. Now let me say that again, okay? I want you to understand this. If you take a look at household debt, that's your mortgage, your car payment, your student loans, your credit cards, your personal loans, your loans, all the debt in all the households in America, according to the quantitative analysts who create these numbers, is $17.3 trillion. 17.3 multiplied by 2 is like $34.6 trillion. Isn't that interesting that the household debt of the United States is half of what the federal government is right now? Okay, that's a big problem. Now, the household debt at 17 that went up, $228 billion, that included $48 billion increase in credit card debt. Credit card debt today is 1.08, let's just say $1 trillion for everybody's credit cards. Add it all up, it's $1 trillion. Well, you know, federal debt is $33 trillion, and it's going to go to $35. So when you look at that number over the last 8 quarters, and if you look every quarter, you look year before, year over year for 8 quarters, that's up 8 quarters in a row for 2 years that credit card debt keeps creeping up. And it creeps up because people aren't, you know, these are times when people will, you know, use their credit cards to buy food, clothing, and perhaps even shelter and, you know, transportation and necessities. So what it's telling you is that the population is mimicking or emulating the federal government, and that they're borrowing to sustain. It's just the federal government is. I mean, it's not the federal government is just borrowing money and, you know, burning it in a pile somewhere. They borrow and spend. And we're seeing that reflected in American households as well, which is a very dangerous thing, because if you're trying to manage your assets and, you know, assets minus debt or assets minus liabilities is your equity, that's your net worth. Take all your assets minus your debt, that's your net worth. If you're trying to grow your net worth and preserve your assets, then, you know, debt should be small. And what this is telling us is that by necessity, people are moving this forward. And that's why there's a Fannie Mae is a mortgage insurance, I don't want to say scheme, but it's a mortgage insurance plan that was set up a long, long time ago with the idea that it would provide insurance on mortgages that are more leveraged. And a lot of people have, Fannie and Freddie. And effectively what they do is it's a gigantic pool, and they buy mortgages. And if you meet the Fannie and Freddie standards, they'll buy the mortgage. It creates liquidity in the mortgage market so people can buy homes. And it is one of the great, you know, liquefiers of mortgage money. And they do surveys, and their current survey says 85% of Americans said that it's a bad time to buy a house because of high prices and high interest rates. And that's a double whammy, because it's a supply and demand issue on the price of housing. There are so few homes available, and, you know, the demand is so high, even at the 8%, that the prices are high and the interest rates are high. And then of that population, 78% say the economy is on the wrong track. Well, going into an election year, you really don't want to hear, you know, that, you know, after 4 years of my administration, the economy's on the wrong track. That isn't good. And this is apparently, according to Fannie Mae, when they sample the persons on the street, this is the type of results. You know, if it was, you know, 48, 52, you think, well, you know, but 78% are saying that the economy is on the wrong track. And that's a real problem, because 47% of the people they surveyed said that interest rates will continue to rise. And of course, we've had a little bit of softening in the interest rate market. It peaked at about 8.45. And mortgage interest rates are very, very much, they're fluid. They're fluid because, again, supply and demand. And if, you know, demand starts to dwindle for a mortgage, the banks will cut their rates a little. If demand is high, you know, the rates go up. But the rates have dropped on average from 8.45% to 7.82%. So we're basically looking at, you know, about 0.5% up or down. And anybody who's ever priced a mortgage, you know that those numbers move around. You have to lock in your rate because they change weekly, if not, you know, even more frequently. And at the end of the day, you end up with, you know, the a fluid rate. I also noticed that packaged mortgage securities are showing an increased the way mortgages work, and I've mentioned this before, is that they're most of the time they're very standard conventional mortgages, and the notes are bundled into a securitized instrument and they're sold to institutional investors. So pension funds, hedge funds, 401ks, IRA account, whatever, they will buy mortgage-backed securities. And that creates, again, liquidity in the marketplace, because if a bank can originate a loan and then bundle it and package it and sell it off to a syndicate, then they can get the money back and they can keep making loans. So it creates a lot of liquidity. It's a very good thing. And it has really allowed, you know, millions and millions of people to buy homes at reasonable interest rates. But the people who are investing in those securitized mortgage instruments are asking for higher rates. They're saying, you know, the risk is problematic. If you go back to 2008 and you look at the problems with people starting to default on those liar loans, and, you know, they were given mortgages that were way bigger than they should have been, and people started to default, and the default went from like 3% to 4, 5, 6%, the whole financial system just came unhinged. And we had this major bank meltdown, and, you know, Lehman Brothers went away, and it was just a complete financial disaster in 2007, 2008. And as a result of that, we're starting to see these pools of mortgages, they're asking for higher interest rates. And at the same time, we're seeing that the federal bank regulators are starting to push for higher reserve ratios and stronger balance sheets on banks, which means they're looking at debt, commercial debt, and institutional debt and mortgage debt, and saying that you're going to have to discount those notes a little deeper in order to shore up your balance sheet. And of course, as such, that puts pressure on banks and bank shareholders to either off-put that risk through they re-syndicate it or basically reinsure it to other holders, or they're, you know, adjusting their rates higher to compensate. So a lot of those pressures we're seeing are built into the system right now as a result of this push at the, you know, the federal level to be spending vast amounts of money, and the Treasury is the largest by far issuer in the debt markets. They're driving that market. And these are the manifestations we're seeing on the ground. So anyway, we'll talk more about this tomorrow, of course. But thank you so much for tuning in to the Eastman Financial Report and also WVW-TV. It's always our pleasure to be able to present our materials. So have a great afternoon. Talk to you later. Bye.